If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Today we've got a conversation about the role of medieval women in the Crusades with Natasha Hodgson. Natasha is senior lecturer in medieval history at Nottingham Trent University, where she's also the director of the Centre for the Study of Religion and Conflict. Putting the questions to her was our content director, Dave Musgrove.
I'm here in Nottingham today, and I am joined by Dr. Natasha Hodgson, who is Director of the Centre for the Study of Religion and Conflict at Nottingham Trent University. And she has a particular interest in the history of the Crusades, but more specifically, women in the Crusades. You've written a book, Natasha, entitled Women Crusading and the Holy Land in Historical Narrative, along with numerous other journal articles and some other stuff on masculinities that we were just talking about before we started recording. So welcome to the podcast. Thank you for joining.
Thank you.
So I wanted to talk to you about women in the Crusades. I've read through your book and found it fascinating, lots of things to talk about. So first up, the Crusades, I think it's not unreasonable to say would be widely seen as a pretty male thing. When you're thinking about the Crusades, you think of the big figures, you know, your Richard the First, your Philip the Second, your Baldwin of Jerusalem, you know, big, big male names. Am I completely off kilter to start with by saying it's a male thing?
Not at all. I think that is how crusading is sort of perceived in the popular Western imagination these days. You know, it's seen to be a knightly endeavour. It's the kind of thing that people associate with kind of romantic ideals of knights on quests. And, you know, and the sort of delivery of the Holy Land. A lot of these images are actually kind of more a product of later sources, so particularly 19th century art and literature, things like Walter Scott, for example. You know, they kind of have cemented this idea of crusading in people's minds as a knightly endeavour, when in fact, you know, there are a large swathe of people from across all social levels going on crusade during the period in which crusading's at its height.
Okay. And we talked about this before. And do you want to very quickly sketch a mini history of the Crusades?
Most people, as you say, would be familiar with some big names who went on crusades or maybe an expedition or two. Obviously, we have the First Crusade, which is called in 1095 by Pope Urban II. And this is the sort of major event which sets crusading in motion over the next few centuries. It's the success of the capture of the Holy City of Jerusalem in 1099, which makes people believe, actually, this is something that God wants us to do, and they continue doing it from that point onwards. So we have a series of major expeditions, but we also have a lot of smaller ones as people, you know, want to visit the holy places, And this strong connection between crusade and pilgrimage means that people are travelling back and forth to the Holy Land for a good 200-year period in which Latin settlers are present in the Levant.
Brilliant. Okay, good summation. So your work has been trying to readdress this this story a bit and try and put women back into the picture for us. So give us a sense of the main areas in which we can see women in the story.
So I've tried to think about this in terms of three different groups of women, really. First of all, those women who do actually go on crusade. So they are present. We know less about them than we do the men, but we can trace at least 91 individuals who take the cross during this period, 1095 to 1291. And then, large numbers of women are also mentioned en masse by chroniclers, although some of those accounts may be a bit questionable. Then we have those women who are present in the settler society in the Latin East. So the ones who either come out with the crusaders or crusaders marry and develop family relationships with and settle with out in the East. They then have a role in kind of providing continuity out in the new settler society, and their lives are often affected by new crusades coming out, marrying into new groups of crusaders, that kind of thing. And then we have the women back at home, whose lives are also significantly affected by this large portion of the male population disappearing off on crusade, and whether that involved supporting them financially or whether that involved taking on the reins of, you know, more traditional male roles while men were away. Those are all different ways in which women's lives were affected. And of course, there are the ones who are victims, you know, of crusading activity as well. So there's lots of different areas in which we can think about women's involvement in the Crusades.
And maybe we'll take those one by one in a second, but we should say we're talking, your research is focused on the experience of women from Christendom, from the Western world. Have you looked at the people on the other side of the story at all?
Certainly, you know, we do get the accounts of Muslim women being involved in some crusading activity, most often as, say, victims of crusading activity. But if we're looking at them through the lens of Western Latin sources, we also have to treat their depiction with some suspicion at times. So sometimes, for example, Guibert of Nogent describes women in Kerboga of Mosul's army. This is the army that besieges the first crusaders inside Antioch in 1098, as like Diana with archers present, and, you know, kind of in quite masculine terms. We also hear about, in several sources, Kerboga's mother, who was supposedly a sorceress, who came and tried to persuade him not to fight against the Franks because they were definitely going to beat him. I mean, you know, we have to take stories like that with a pinch of salt. So it's difficult to know precisely, you know, who's involved, from the Frankish perspective, at least. The Arabic sources do tell us a bit about some women who were involved in positions of power, particularly during the early 12th century in the sort of Turkic areas. But possibly one of the most interesting, actually, is from a 13th century example of Shajar al-Dur, who is essentially, briefly, Sultan of Egypt while Louis IX's crusade is attacking, and she's actually kind of involved in turning them back at Mansura. So, yeah, she's, you know, there are Muslim women involved as well, of course.
She sounds fascinating. Yeah. Sounds like someone who wants to know more about.
Yeah.
Okay, so going back to the subjects of your research. So women who went on crusade, you said you'd identified 91 individuals or thereabouts, or
yeah,
their reference. Who were they? What were they doing?
I mean, so the majority of the ones that we know about are obviously noble, and this is largely to do with the fact that the priority of people recording events at the time, they were most interested in the deeds of the aristocracy, the important people. So if they appear in chronicle sources, you know, they're most likely, and they're named, then they're likely to be important noble people. People like Queen Eleanor of Aquitaine or Marguerite of Provence, you know, these big names. When it gets kind of lower down the social scale, it's a little bit more difficult to find out. So less an ability we might find about, say, for example, from crusade charters, if a crusader left a charter behind to say that they were intending to go to the Holy Land. And in those cases, it's very often a husband and wife who might be doing that. Or you might hear about them on their return. If they gave a gift of relics or something to a monastery, they might then, you know, mention that they've been on crusade together. And then when it comes to people really sort of at the bottom of the scale, then we tend to know less about individuals, but more about chroniclers' perspectives of, you know, these kind of large groups of people, which included women. And very often they tend to be a bit more negative because they see these people as slowing down the army, they're non-combatants, using up supplies and food. And possibly the women are leading the crusaders into sexual sin and therefore not really wanted on crusade.
Okay, we'll come back to that in a minute. So is there kind of, you know, the obvious question, is there any evidence that any of these women actually got involved in any of the fighting?
Again, sources are a little bit untrustworthy when it comes to this. Certainly, the Western sources do not really want to highlight women in fighting roles. They want to preserve, because they're coming from an ecclesiastic official perspective, most of them, you know, these texts are being circulated to kind of tell the story of crusading and inspire others in the West to take up the cross. So they don't necessarily really want lots of stories about women fighting. But what we do get is women fighting in extremis, women who are, say, for example, defending the camp at the siege of Damietta during the Fifth Crusade. They are, you know, they repulse a Muslim attack because they're the only ones left defending the camp. And, you know, God lends them strength beyond their natural weakness of their sex in order to do that. So that's kind of okay. So in emergency circumstances, it's okay. And usually when women are described as doing that, they're sort of being told that we're being told that they're taking on masculine roles. So they, you know, that they're described almost as being like men when they do it. There's one interesting example of from a Western perspective, of women at the Siege of Acre on the Third Crusade, who, when a Muslim ship is captured, we're told that the women put them to death using knives instead of swords. And this is seen to be a shameful and painful death because women don't have the strength to do this effectively. So again, you know, we get those kind of odd examples. The only ones really that we have about women fighting as warriors come from an Islamic perspective. And again, a source like, for example, Imad ad-Din for the Third Crusade tells us that there were Frankish women wearing armour on the battlefield, and we didn't even know they were women until we stripped the dead. And then it was realised that some of them were women. But that comes just after a big, long story about how an entire ship of prostitutes came over to support the crusade, with lots of very graphic descriptions about all said prostitutes. So whether we can kind of trust that source, or whether it's telling us more about, you know, what they thought of the Franks and their kind of morality and their, you know, the way in which they allowed women to have these strange and unusual roles is also open to question.
Okay. A couple of interesting women who I wanted to just pick up on. There's a story of this woman who followed her goose on crusade because she believed it was filled with the Holy Spirit. We can't.
Oh, the goose woman. Yes. Well, I mean, this is a story that crops up in two of the sources for the First Crusade. And interestingly, again, it's one of these examples where this is a woman of lower social status. I mean, you know, you can't really get much lower down than looking after the geese. That's a pretty, you know, menial task. But here in Albert of Aachen, he tells us that, you know, a group of people follow a woman who's following a goose and also a she-goat. So he's saying that it's happening in different places. And he calls them stupid and insanely irresponsible or something like that. So he's been quite critical. And sees this as, you know, a foolish endeavour. And similarly, Guibert of Nogent, who talks about this, gives us a bit more information. And there he tells us that the goose actually is following the woman, and they thought it to be imbued with the Holy Spirit. It gets all the way to the altar of the church at Cambrai, and people kind of treat it with reverence. And then they get to Lorraine and the goose dies. And, oh. And Guibert says, well, it would have got to Jerusalem quicker if the woman had cooked it in Etis. So I think in both cases, it's an example of the sorts of people they don't want on crusade. You know, these kind of foolish people who don't have the money, who don't have the resources, who aren't really going to have an effect in the Holy Land. They want military fighting men.
It's used to
kind of discredit. So there's a role that gender plays in some of these texts of actually sort of discrediting those undesirables on crusade.
So presumably she doesn't get named. No. You mentioned Eleanor of Aquitaine and other sort of fairly big figures, but what about Margaret of Beverley?
Well, she is one of the more fascinating characters on crusade, I think, and more so because she's not precisely a noble woman. I mean, she must have been of fairly independent means. She's sometimes called Margaret of Beverley, sometimes called Margaret of Jerusalem. She was born out in the Holy Land while her parents were on pilgrimage there sometime in the mid-12th century. And then they come back to Beverley in Yorkshire, just north of Hull. And she grows up there. She has a younger brother, Thomas, who ends up in the circle of Thomas of Canterbury, Thomas Becket. Mm-hmm. And her brother goes into exile with Thomas Becket in France and ends up in the monastery of Froidmont. We don't know whether Margaret ever got married or anything like that, but it seems that once he's out of the picture, she is freed up in later life to return to the land of her birth. So she goes back to Jerusalem, and she arrives just in time for Saladin to besiege the city in 1187.
That's unfortunate time.
Yes, and she fights on the walls of Jerusalem. So here is one example of potentially a woman fighting. But what we're told is that she carries water to the troops on the walls. She wears a cooking pot on her head as a helmet, and she throws, you know, weapons at the enemy. So she's kind of not in an official capacity, but again, in extremis, she's trying to fight. And she gets wounded by a millstone, which is thrown onto the walls, and she gets shrapnel in her leg from the millstone and has a scar to show for it. And then following Saladin's capture of the city, she is one of the lucky few who has enough money to buy her way out of captivity. But soon afterwards is then taken into captivity and spends 15 months as a slave doing hard labour. She manages to get bought out of slavery, continues doing various pilgrimages around the Holy Land, has another brief period of slavery. She carries with her a Psalter, a prayer book, and this is her one prized possession. Following all of those adventures, it seems that the aftermath of the Third Crusade, in 1192, she travels home with the Third Crusaders after having been allowed to visit the holy places by Saladin, and then goes on more pilgrimage. She goes to Compostela, she goes to Rome, and finally ends up in France meeting up with her brother. And he doesn't recognise her, we're told, because it's been such a long time since they've seen each other. And she has to tell them the names of their parents so that he knows who she is. And then he encourages her to enter a nunnery, which she does, a Cistercian convent in near Lyon. And she spends the next 18 years of her life there. And we know about all this because her brother writes down her story after her death in around 1214. And it's this kind of poetic elegy. And there are obviously, you know, very sort of Christ-like spiritual elements with her kind of wandering in the wilderness and going to all these holy places. But at the same time, you know, it's such a fascinating story. And it's obviously something that he thought the Cistercian nuns of her convent would like to read and reflect on after her death and to sort of celebrate her life. So yeah, she's one of the most fantastic, characters, I think, that we come across.
Yeah, brilliant. Is this idea of her fighting with a cooking pot on her head,
yes.
is that in some way sort of mocking her?
It almost seems to be, yeah. I mean, this is such an ad hoc experience. But it's also a kind of, I'm doing what I can, this is an important, for her, the crusade is kind of it's about her devotion to Christ, and so is her entrance into the convent. And so she's doing what she can with what's available to her as a woman, and taking on manly roles when necessary as an example to others, I think, is sort of key message there.
So sounds like she went to the Holy Land in her own capacity, sort of under her own steam.
Yes.
Yeah. But there's this interesting bit here about how wives could either refuse permission for their husbands to go on crusade, or it actually had a legitimate right to go on crusade with their husbands. Am I right with those two points?
Yeah. I mean, the marriage vow is an interesting one, in the sense that it seems that from the early stages, women were not really encouraged to go on crusade. And there were concerns that if men were spending a long time away from their wives, that either husband or wife might be tempted into adultery. These trips to the Holy Land, you're looking at kind of 2 years at least round trip, and it takes longer for some crusades. So both people have to be in agreement that during that time they will not render unto each other, anybody else, the conjugal debt, as it were. So it's almost like, they have to agree to continence while the two of them are apart. Obviously some crusaders decide to take their wives with them. And if they do, that might be seen as an indication that they were looking to find somewhere to settle, as opposed to thinking about returning. But some husbands and wives do go and return. But there is this constant worry about, wives inhibiting men from going on crusade, men being too worried about their wives and children that they might not take the cross. So the church puts in place these special protections. So you are entitled to if you take the cross, you're entitled to the protection of the church for your lands and property while you're away. And then a wife, if they experience some trouble, can appeal to the church for help while they're away. And, this happens with varying degrees of success, but we do have some fairly high profile examples, like Sybil of Flanders, who while her husband Thierry is off on crusade, Baldwin IV of Hainaut tries to invade. She's heavily pregnant and has to kind of coordinate a military action against him, and sort of calls on the church for aid in her right as through the protection of the church.
Okay. But there are some examples of wives going on crusade with their husband.
Yeah.
And how did that go? Do we have any evidence of, it seemed like a slightly unusual thing to do, to go on crusade with your wife. Do we get any examples of the relationship?
Yes. I mean, I think the most famous example is going to be Louis the Ninth and his wife Marguerite of Provence. So they go on crusade together. She has a fairly key role in the history of Joinville, who writes about Louis' time on crusade. I think because Joinville himself had a reasonably close relationship with the Queen. So we find out a bit more about how they are feeling and getting on with each other. And at one point he thinks that Louis, rather cold towards her and, doesn't pay her enough attention. But they manage to have three children while on that crusade. So, there's still obviously marital activity going on, and Marguerite's not criticised for any of that sort of thing. She's also in a position where, when Louis is taken into captivity after the Battle of Mansoura, she is effectively in charge of the army, and she's heavily pregnant in Damietta, trying to negotiate with the enemy and build up a ransom to get Louis back, and begging with, various groups not to abandon them and disappear. She was in a very difficult situation, but without her, feasibly, the they wouldn't have been able to raise the ransom. So at times, you know, as in the same way as in the West, when male authority was lacking, women could step in to that breach and, you know, kind of take control of events, but usually only in those extreme circumstances.
Okay.
Having said that, attitudes towards wives do change in the 13th century a bit more. So Innocent III, during his papacy, he tries to be a bit more inclusive towards women in the sense that he allows them to have spiritual benefits, the spiritual benefits that he gives to crusaders, if they finance someone to go on crusade. So he's trying to kind of allow them the spiritual benefits that they want, but stop them from actually participating quite so much. So it's a kind of double whammy, really. And it's at a time when crusading is becoming more professionalised. People tend to travel more by ship. So really then, I think we're beginning to see fewer women getting involved on a kind of grassroots level in crusading than we saw in the big armies that were going across by land in the 12th century.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
We then have another example from Gerald of Wales. He talks about a particular nobleman whose wife, who takes the cross, but when he gets home, his wife says, no way, you can't go. And then a few days later, she rolls over in her sleep and kills her child in her sleep. And this is seen as a judgment of God for her not allowing him to go on crusades.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
So do we have much of a sense of the makeup of these crusader parties then? So you had some numbers in one of your sections, which was on the Saint Victor, a crusade ship of 1250, there were 42 of the 342 common people en route to the Holy Land were women. So a percentage of that crusader party were female. So is that indicative? Is that a good sort of number to be thinking about?
Yeah, I mean it's an interesting one. That one. I mean it's described as a ship carrying pilgrims. So again, you know, is this just kind of the normal pilgrim traffic? One of the big problems for women is how do we distinguish between women as crusaders or just ordinary pilgrims? Because a lot of the time, you know, there isn't a word for crusade in the 12th century. And those who are on crusade are usually just described as pilgrims. So, that ship list, you know, could be just ordinary pilgrimage traffic. It could be that, you know, these are people involved or going out to support Louis the Ninth Crusade is happening in Egypt at that time. So it's questionable, really, whether those women could be called crusaders, but certainly it tells us that pilgrim traffic is ongoing to the Holy Land, you know, throughout this period, and that there is a desire amongst women to go to the holy places. And the interesting thing with that as well is that many of those are unattached women. So you might find, for example, a group of widows might travel together in order to, you know, ensure their safety on pilgrimage. But there's always concern about, you know, whether they can be safe.
Hmm. But notwithstanding those reservations, there must have been a requirement for certain roles to be fulfilled in any crusader party that may have been traditional women's roles, you know, mm-hmm. healthcare, medicine.
Yeah.
That, you know, presumably there were jobs that needed doing that would have would have been suited to women of the age?
Yes, and you do find women in auxiliary roles quite a lot in the source material. So, I mean, this is one of the things that sort of first interested me in the topic when I came to study it was, you know, you'd have these big departure scenes at the beginning where the Crusaders said goodbye to their wives and, you know, then their loved ones and all the rest of it. And then all of a sudden, there'd be a little sentence here or there saying, oh, and the women did this or the women did that. It's like, who are these women and where did they come from?
Yeah.
Very often they're involved in doing things like helping the army build camps, digging ditches, bringing water to fighting soldiers. So providing, you know, potentially sort of basic food and looking after animals.
Yeah.
So all of those kinds of things. So traditional kind of servant roles. Also holding markets, you know, so getting involved in kind of in ensuring that food supply is going on. We have a female practitioner of medicine who looks after St. Louis when he's ill following the Battle of Mansoura. So yeah, they do perform these kinds of roles as well. The most famous one are the lice pickers or the washerwomen. So you have in the ordinances of Henry II when he was planning to go on the Third Crusade, he said only washerwomen of good repute can come. And similarly, on the Third Crusade, when they were traveling, there was a recommendation that only sort of washerwomen who were as good as monkeys for picking fleas, says Amboise, were allowed to come with them. So this was seen to be an important role.
Okay. Yeah. But in these Crusades parties, you alluded to this earlier. There is this question of the danger that women posed to these Crusade parties. I suppose not only in the fidelity of the Crusaders, but also the spiritual purity of the Crusades. Is that a thing?
I mean, usually sort of, even when taking a pilgrimage vow, you know, the idea about this is penance. And if you're in a state of penance, you know, you don't really want to be engaging in sort of sexual activity and those kind of things. So when a Crusader takes a vow, you know, they're essentially becoming a temporary ecclesiastic to some extent. And, you know, the idea of illicit sexual activity in particular is frowned upon. There are questions over whether it was okay to have sex with your wife while you were on crusade or not.
It was okay for Louis.
But that source is written by a secular author. So he's potentially not so bothered. I mean, he does have a certain morality and certainly doesn't think it's appropriate for people to be engaging with prostitutes, which he does criticise people for.
Mm.
So I think there are big concerns that if the Crusaders step out of line and are sinful, then the Crusade will not be successful. They will not achieve military success. And we see particularly on the First Crusade, there are times when, you know, they have penitential processions, they have big meetings where they set out, you know, rules for behaviour because things have been going badly. And in order to make sure they're successful, they need to ensure that that the Crusaders aren't being sinful. One of the big cases is the Siege of Antioch. Now, this was an incredibly hard siege. It was 8 months. They were stuck outside the city, constantly being attacked by various different forces. There was a lot of concern about the kind of spiritual purity of the Crusaders. So we have a situation where they, you know, have a big council and they decide to implement, you know, quite strict rules about sexual engagement and all this kind of thing. And when shortly afterwards a prostitute is found with her pimp, in one source we get told he was a cleric, and they are stripped naked and whipped through the camp as an example to everybody not to engage in this type of behaviour. Fulker of Chartres, who wasn't actually there, also tells us that all the women were put away from the camp, both you know, the married and the unmarried. But again, he wasn't there, so whether we can fully believe his sources is open to question. But certainly it was something that people were concerned about, and you know, it comes across very strongly in the sources that this type of behaviour will not make a successful crusade.
Okay. Right, we talked a bit there about the women who went on crusades, but you also mentioned the ones who stayed at home, and mm-hmm. you flagged up the fundraising role that some of these women played. So mm-hmm. tell me a bit about that. How important were women as the fundraisers for the crusades?
Well, they could be involved in a number of different ways. So from the earliest stages, we do see, for example, in crusade charters, women giving assent to some of their lands being mortgaged or possibly even sold in order to help finance a crusader to go on crusade. And then, as I say, with Innocent III, we get this new kind of development where basically, you know, anyone can contribute financially to the crusade, you know, and can give as much or as little as they have towards it and get those spiritual rewards that they want. So that allows women then to donate, to take the cross, but then commute their vows for cash. So they can pay a fee and that will go towards the general pot to support a knight to go on crusade instead. And that becomes the kind of norm going forward. But of course, women could be involved in other ways as well. Prayer was also seen to be a very effective thing. So Anne Lester's book on Cistercian nuns is particularly eloquent on this, and talking about how, you know, these women were seen to be providing spiritual support by praying on behalf of the crusaders. And this is something that people were keen to encourage and create connections with those monasteries. In addition, we have specific holy women who get involved in the idea of crusading. So Philip of Flanders, when he goes on his crusade in 1177, writes to Hildegard of Bingen, as a sort of famous 12th century visionary, asking her, you know, how do I make a successful crusade? You know, so he seeks her advice. So there's a variety of different ways in which they could be involved in sort of financial and spiritual support. And then there's the practical day-to-day running of affairs. So you might find individuals like Adela of Blois, for example, who acts as regent while her husband, Stephen of Blois, goes on crusade. She's the daughter of William the Conqueror and quite a formidable woman by all accounts. Stephen himself is taken ill at the Siege of Antioch and returns home. He's one of those so-called deserters from the First Crusade. And apparently when he gets back, she's so ashamed of him that she gives him a flea in his ear in the bedroom and tells him to go back on crusade, which he does, and then dies in 1101. Right. So, yeah.
Is there any sense that there's anything going on like in the Second World War when women were, they became land girls and they were able to take on these masculine roles and sort of and change the paradigm for themselves a bit? Did anything like that happen in the Crusader period?
I think the question is, like, what was the norm at that time? And, you know, we do tend to think that noble women were quite restricted. But actually, recent works do tend to suggest that actually, you know, women were taking control in the absence of husbands on quite a regular basis. And if they weren't fighting on the Crusades, they would be fighting somewhere else on behalf of their lord. So I think with Crusades, the duration is long. You know, so you could expect someone to be away for quite a long time, and that might potentially make a difference. But that's only for the noble classes. I mean, unfortunately, we have much less information about those people lower down the social scale who are going on crusade and how that impacts on people at home. You know, who takes on the roles within, you know, either urban environments or rural environments. During that period, that's very difficult to say.
Okay, and then there's this point that we touched on a bit earlier about the question of consent, about whether women wives wanted their husbands to go on crusade, and you just flagged up an example of someone who sent their husband back. could they get involved in the conversations about it? Could they stop their husbands from going? Did they want to, or were they generally more actively encouraging them to go? What do we know about that?
Again, we get a sort of mixture of views. but very little actual hard evidence. So, for example, we have sermons by Jacques of Vitry, who was a preacher for the Fifth Crusade. He sort of gave these example sermons where he describes having given a sermon on the Crusades and somebody's wife stopped him from going to hear the sermon by locking him in an attic. But he managed to escape and jump out the window and take the cross anyway. But we have no names named, you know, no specific sort of information. We then have another example from Gerald of Wales. He talks about a particular nobleman whose wife, who takes the cross, but when he gets home, his wife says, "No way, you can't go." And then a few days later, she rolls over in her sleep and kills her child in her sleep. And this is seen as a judgment of God for her not allowing him to go on crusade. So again, they're very moral kind of stories. But difficult to kind of pinpoint, you know, an individual who actually puts their foot down and says, "No, you can't go."
Okay.
I mean, we hear Louis the Ninth's mum, Blanche of Castile, was apparently not keen on him going on crusade, mainly because she'd just spent a really long time in the Regency trying to sort France out so that he had an inheritance to come into. But once he'd sort of made it clear that this is what he wanted to do, she supports him and acts as regent for him again while he's away. So yeah, there's definitely the impression from the sources that women are reluctant to let their menfolk go. But we then do have examples from Third Crusade Chronicles, which say that brides incited their husbands and mothers incited their sons to go on the crusade. So it's, yeah, that we get evidence from both sides, really.
Okay. Now, charging back across geographically to the Crusader states, mm-hmm. one of your other categories of women involved was women in the Crusader states. So what was going on there? How were women involved in the actual Crusader states?
Well, I think initially we have situations where some of the first Crusaders take wives from Christian communities out in the east. So particularly around Edessa, you find people marrying into the Armenian Christian community. But then, especially with the Kingdom of Jerusalem, we get a situation whereby in the mid-12th century, a woman inherits, Queen Melisande, and her sisters all have important roles in the other so-called Crusader states. So they become kind of integral to the politics during that period. And a series of kind of female rulers then occur in the later sort of 12th century as well. So they have kind of quite a strong presence. And I think just generally, you know, there's you know, consistent warfare going on in throughout this period. So numbers of the aristocracy are coming out and dying, and then there are usually, you know, a supply of widows or daughters or for new crusaders to marry. So they're providing this kind of network, kinship network, really, that keeps things going, and often again, you know, acting in quite prominent political roles.
We're heading a bit over time, but it's so interesting. There's one question that I think we do need to think about a bit, is which you look at in your work, is kind of the nature of the sources about the Crusades and how they maybe skew how we look at them, and that as you point out, sort of is a result of the sort of people who are writing about the Crusades. So just tell us a bit about that.
Yeah.
Are we getting a skewed view because of the nature of the sources that survive?
I think, well, for the Western sources, you know, we are kind of dependent largely on male ecclesiastic writers who are trying to present the Crusade in a certain light. So with the First Crusade, for example, we have maybe a few that are eyewitness accounts, but most of them, again, are written by clergy. There's one, potentially, the anonymous Gesta Francorum, that we think may have been written by a lay person. But again, they're all very religious in tone. They all have a particular agenda, and the majority of them are written after the successful capture of the the city of Jerusalem. So they're kind of explaining how this amazing and miraculous event, as they see it, occurred and how God allowed it to happen. So it's part of their sort of historical explanation of events. And those texts are then being circulated in order to help encourage and enthuse more people to go on crusade. So they have an agenda in that they want to get the right sort of people. They want to appeal to knights. They want to appeal to nobles. They want to have military men of fighting age. So they can be quite critical of women as a group, but they can also be critical of, you know, poor people, non-combatants, those people who are slowing down the army. So that they're very critical, for example, of the first wave of crusaders who go in 1096, what we sometimes call the People's Crusade, precisely for those reasons. It was seemed to be an unorganised, disorganised rabble of peasants and women and everything else who were sinful and dreadful, and this is why God didn't allow them to be successful. Whereas the next group that were led by, you know, important named noblemen that we have, you know, a lot of information about and who were set up as crusade heroes, effectively, there seem to be the sort of people that they want to encourage to crusade. So there's kind of two main reasons really for excluding women, I think, is that, you know, first of all, they don't want to encourage women to go. And second of all, you know, crusading is predominantly a military activity. And as we've discussed, women have limited roles in those events. They tend to be more auxiliary roles than being involved in the actual fighting.
And that touches on another of your research areas, this question of masculinity in the period. And so I suppose these sources are looking to present this idea of the masculine superhero male warrior type thing.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, that is nowhere more evident, really, in the treatment of Godfrey of Bouillon, who is a first crusader who, I mean, to be fair, if you read some of the some accounts of his activities on crusade, he's not particularly outstanding in terms of his achievements on the crusade, although in later sources, increasingly, we hear about him doing marvellous feats of military might, cutting a Turk in half with a single blow, that kind of thing. And this is largely to sort of explain to people how and why he is chosen to be King of Jerusalem, you know, ultimately, out of the crusaders that are left when they capture the city. And Godfrey dies shortly after taking on this role. I mean, he says he doesn't want to be king in the city where Christ was king. So he calls himself the advocate or defender of the holy city, and then dies soon afterwards. So he becomes this almost mythical figure, mainly, I think, because he didn't have time to put a foot wrong. but he is, you know, in later sort of stories and romances, there's stories about him being descended from a swan. There's he's included in one of the nine worthies, so alongside Charlemagne and King Arthur, you know, these key sort of mythical figures. And the masculinity is and the it sort of combines with the era of chivalry. You know, when the notion of chivalry is coming to its height at the end of the 12th century, I think that, you know, they try to create an ideal of crusading based on the knight, you know, the martial military figure of the knight. And this is your kind of, you know, ideal person to go on crusade. And it's one reason for kind of, you know, excluding others from that narrative.
Women don't fit into that.
Right? Yeah. Well, the only reason they do is if they put other men to shame. So, you know, if they're acting beyond their sex and even women are doing something, then all of you sitting listening who haven't taken the cross should feel ashamed of yourself. That's kind of the
okay. So, sort of wrapping up, is there anything obvious that I've missed? Any big strands in your research that we should have talked about?
Oh goodness. I mean, obviously, I work quite a lot. I've done a lot of work on women and men in the context of the crusade. I'm also particularly interested in the role of clergy, because, of course, clergy go on crusade as well, and they exist in this sort of world where they're not supposed to be fighting, and yet they need to be present on crusade because they have to provide spiritual guidance for the army. And they kind of occupy this really interesting space as well in comparison to women and men on crusade. And they're kind of still trying to be defined in masculine terms. But when they can't fight, how do they still kind of explain their usefulness in the context of the army? So that's another kind of area for investigation. But to talk for another day, perhaps.
I mean, you've got the likes of your Odo of Bayeux in the Norman Conquest, who's famously in the Battle of Hastings holding his club, and he's holding it because it's a club which isn't going to shed blood. Was that?
That's the idea. And Odo, of course, goes on the First Crusade, but then dies. So he dies in Sicily. So he was, you know, prepared to undertake that journey. It would have been really interesting to see what would happen. Adhemar of Lepuy becomes the papal legate for the First Crusade. So he's sort of from southern France in the contingent of Raymond of Saint-Gilles. And, you know, there's questions over, was he actually involved in military activity or not? Certainly some sources suggest that, you know, he does play kind of a significant role in the fighting. And it goes totally against, in some ways, the narrative of the Reformed papacy at this time that clergy are not supposed to be involved in fighting.
Mm. Okay. Mm. And so, sort of the final thing there. So, where's your research going next with this? Are you going to be exploring some new avenues?
So obviously we had following on from women crusading in the Holy Land last year. We produced a collection of essays, myself, Catherine Lewis and Matthew Mesley, on crusading and masculinities, which was great, actually, because we've got people looking, like people from the field of gender studies who hadn't really looked at the Crusades before to try and discuss some of these aspects, but also well-known Crusade historians. Moving on from that, I'm working on a book on gender and the Crusades for Palgrave Macmillan, which I hope will be out next year. To be continued. I think there's plenty more life in this topic yet, I think, and it's a really exciting field to be involved in at the moment.
Brilliant, thank you. Okay, Natasha, thank you so much. Thank you for your time. So that's Natasha Hodgson from Nottingham Trent University, and we look forward to your book. Does it have a title yet?
Gender and the Crusades.
Gender and the Crusades. We'll look forward to that next year, and maybe we'll come back and talk to you again on the History Extra podcast. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
That was Natasha Hodgson. You can find plenty more podcasts and articles on the Crusades on our website, at historyextra.com/crusades. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Join us tomorrow for another medieval podcast when Gordon Noble will be speaking about the Picts.